Welcome to Africa's LSP podcast, where we explore the world of translation, interpretation, and localization, as well as connect with the language industry's top players. From language service providers to the businesses and individuals who rely on their services, we'll be delving into the challenges, opportunities, and trends shaping the industry. Join us as we discover the power of language and the impact it has on connecting Africa and the world. Brought to you by Bolingo Consult and hosted by Nat Kintela, Africa's LSP podcast is the go-to podcast for all things language in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Africa's LSP podcast. I'm your usual host, Nat Kintela, and today we have another remarkable guest whose contributions to the world of localization and language services in Africa cannot be overemphasized. Now, if you're in the localization business in and around sub-Saharan Africa, you must have heard of Ear Candy. Right. For those of you who haven't, Ear Candy is a leading localization and audio post-production studio offering services such as dubbing, translation, transcription, subtitling, among others. And we are blessed to have one of the brains behind this localization powerhouse with us today. I'm going to let her introduce herself properly in a bit, but before that, join me in welcoming Lois Calcott-Stevens to Africa's LSP podcast. Hi, Lois. We're honored to have you here with us today.
Hi, Nat. Thanks so much for having me. I'm sorry that I sound so sinusy today. It's the joys of living in Johannesburg over this dry period before the rains come. But I'm looking forward to having a chat with you.
That's fine, Lois. That's fine. So, like I said earlier on, would you mind telling our audience who you are and what you do?
I'm Louise Calcott-Stevens. I am the co-founder and CEO of Ear Candy, which is a content localization company based in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Great. CEO of a localization company and a trailblazing one at that. Was this always your dream career? I mean, in a world where every child is encouraged to become a lawyer, an engineer, a doctor, and so on, I'm quite curious to know what inspired your choice of career.
Thanks, Nat. That's a great question. In a nutshell, no. I never dreamed that I would become the CEO of a localization company. In fact, I always say that the only reason why I am one is that I happened to marry a sound engineer at some point in time. But if I'm to talk about being, you know, as you say, lawyers, engineers, doctors, yeah, funnily enough, when I was at school, lawyer was probably about the only professional option that was open to me because I wasn't particularly good at academics in general at school. So yeah, I think what I can say to you is that I always had a sense that there was something beyond being an employee. I grew up in a household where we were pretty anti-establishment. So my dad was, you know, a child of the 60s, and he always used to say, never work for the man. So I think by the time I finished school and I realized that being a lawyer definitely wasn't for me because my attention to detail is not great. I'm very much a big picture thinker. I knew that I had to start looking for alternatives. What I can also say is that growing up during apartheid in South Africa, there weren't a lot of options open to women in general.
Right.
And I know that I was very privileged. I grew up white and I went to private schools. But what I'm very clear on now is that if at school they hadn't pushed the idea that, you know, you either were lucky and smart and became an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer, or there really wasn't much other option for you. If somebody had have told me then that there was something called business, you know, being an entrepreneur, that you could have an idea and you could figure out how you're going to bring that idea into fruition and then build a business around it, I certainly think that my trajectory as an entrepreneur would have been a whole lot quicker than it has been.
Awesome. That's a truly inspiring journey, Lois. And I hope that as parents and as school teachers, we learn to inculcate this into our words. I mean, help children understand that there's more to this life than becoming a doctor, a lawyer, etc. Thanks once again for sharing that, Lois. Now, could you share with us the story behind how Ear Candy started and what actually motivated you to focus on localization?
Thanks, Nat. That's such a great question, and I always love answering that because there's a really interesting story, I think, behind it, and it speaks to what I was saying about being an entrepreneur and going into business. And it was interesting because I hosted a breakfast in Cape Town last week for African Women in Entertainment, or Ear Candy did, and the phenomenal Dr. Mo Abadou told us her story around how she became successful. And I just always find, you know, hearing someone's story is always interesting because there's so many factors that are common, right. But the situation around it and the circumstances always differ. So as I said before, the only reason why I ended up in localization is that I happened to be married to a sound engineer. At the time, Ear Candy was a small little audio post-production hot shop. And we had a couple of sound engineers and did cool work on formats and drama series and reality shows. And essentially what happened is one day I got a call from a woman who worked at the big broadcaster down the road. And I happened to be in the office on that day because I wasn't even really involved in Ear Candy at the time. And I got this call and she said, "Do you dub?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. I'll have to ask Brett," who had, you know, co-founded Ear Candy as the post-production facility. And I went to him and I said, "So I've had a call from somebody who has an opportunity and she wants to know if we dub content." And he said, "Absolutely not," except he didn't quite use those words. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because it's beep, beep, beep difficult." And I said, "Well, sorry for you, because we are going to have to learn, because there's certainly something in this."
Right.
And he was right. It is one of the most difficult disciplines. I know that it's considered to be a post-production process, but the reality is that dubbing follows very similar process to, producing a full drama series or animation series,
right.
From a talent perspective and a script, etc. Except what we do is we don't shoot picture.
Exactly.
You know, we literally just revise what's going on. So we recreate the voices around that. So yeah, it is a difficult thing to do. But I think we've worked really hard over the last 15 years at becoming really good at it. But when we started dubbing, I mean, it was in the days before Google was really Google. We couldn't learn very much about it. What I did know is that South Africa used to have a culture of dubbing before we became a democratic society. And when we changed to our new way of being in the country, there was such a negative association to dubbing that literally all the dubbing companies shut down. Mm. And so in order to learn to do what we do, we traveled to France. We were very lucky to be invited into a couple of studios there who really showed us very little but gave us enough to kind of piece pieces together. We came back, looked for software, figured things out, and then we got our first request and we didn't know what we were doing. And then even worse, the client said, "I'm coming to Joburg and I want to come to your studios." We hadn't dubbed a single thing ever. And so what we did is we pulled all of our friends together. We said, "Okay, you need to be this person. You need to be this person." Luckily, we knew some actors. We said, "You hop in the booth. We're going to pretend to be dubbing this movie." And clearly, we were good enough pretenders that the client believed us and said, "Okay, cool. You've got the job."
Right.
And after that, it's really just been a process around learning and understanding, first and foremost, about language and culture on the continent. Because believe me, I knew very little when we started out. And now I can say with pride that I'm very much an African mother tongue advocate. And it was about honing our craft, hiring the right people, because I'm not technical, I'm not operational, and just slowly but surely getting better and better and to the point where we are where we are today. So it really has been an exciting journey.
Wow, amazing story, Lewis. Now, let's dive deeper into the world of localization. In my line of work, I've had the privilege of interacting with several aspects within the language service industries within and beyond Africa. And I've observed that one faction among these professionals asserts the existence of current and tangible demand for localization in Africa. The other faction, however, holds the perspective that while the need for localization in Africa is significant, the demand remains rather prospective. Interestingly, both viewpoints are grounded in the nature of Africa's cultural and linguistic demography. Now, Lewis, per your experience in this industry, I'd like to know what you think about the demand for localization in Africa.
Wow, Nat, that's a big question. Yeah, I think the demand for localization in Africa is, it's always been necessary, but I think that it's becoming more understood. So I was at MIP Africa last week, and I spent a lot of time with producers and distributors who come from across sub-Saharan Africa. And what I can tell you is that we've always told amazing stories. Stories are in our blood. Mm-hmm. But the value of what we are producing is increasing exponentially. And right. I think that that's a really important part of this. So I happened to go to a friend of mine's screening on the Sunday night. She works for a company called Film One in Nigeria. She's the general manager of studios, I think, there. And watched a movie called Adire. And I know I don't pronounce it correctly, but it blew me away. Like, the movie was, it was a human story, and it just happened to be told in Nigeria. And so there were a lot of local nuances around what was going on. But as somebody who, I mean, I love Nigeria and I love Nigerian people, but I'd never been outside of Lagos, I walked away with a really clear view of what that part of the culture looks like within a global context of values and how people view certain parts of society, which I think are global. But I think what becomes important is that as an English first language speaking South African, in order for me to understand the movie, there needed to be subtitles. Because mm-hmm. we tell stories in a multilingual way. We never just speak one language. So in South Africa, as an example, I'm going to speak English, I'm going to throw in a couple of words of Afrikaans, Zulu, I'm going to speak to my friends who come from various cultures. And so there's this really kind of mishmash of how we communicate with each other. And I think that it's consistent across the whole region. The languages just differ depending on where you're from.
Right.
So what is going to be important as we produce better quality content, and that is definitely happening, we're going to need to globalize that content actually into English primarily because that's what the streamers are looking for in order to export our stories. Similarly, while, you know, we import a lot of content onto the continent, I mean, K-drama is just so popular at the moment, you know, those Korean stories need to be dubbed into whatever language it is for the country, or even, you know, a sub-language, one of the languages spoken in the country of destination. Because it's important to remember that while we consider Africa to be Anglophone or Francophone or Lusophone, that's not really the case at all. Right. You know, we've got over 3,000 cultures in Africa as a whole continent, and we speak over 2,000 languages. So it's a given that we need to localize to come in to make international stories relevant for local audiences. And then we need to globalize our content so that people off the continent can connect to the stories that we tell.
Right, right. So moving on, we know that Ear Candy has already localized a staggering number of hours in various languages. Would you be kind enough to share some standout moments or projects where you felt the profound impact of your work on audiences and communities across sub-Saharan Africa?
Thanks, Nat. Yeah, we are very lucky to have worked in over 30 African languages. And I think to say that there's one project that stands out over and above, I think each project and each language and each community that we work with will always have its standout moments. And I think that just connecting with the community that we are localizing the story for in itself is always a standout moment. But I think if I'm to highlight one or two, I mean, the event itself wasn't a directly impacting event, but I remember when we were badged by Netflix to join their Netflix partner program. And that for me, it had taken 2 years of work for us to, you know, move through that process. And it occurred to me in that moment just how important the work that we do is and what the impact of our work has on the community at large. I mean, I think more recently, I happened to be in the airport in Johannesburg, I was going somewhere and we just finished dubbing SpongeBob SquarePants into Zulu, which is, you know, one of the languages that we speak in South Africa that we've done for our client at Paramount. And, you know, the SpongeBob characters are so iconic and the theme tune is so iconic. You know, it's woven into pop culture across the world. And I happened to be running for my gate and a security or a guy in a kind of bright yellow security jacket came running towards me singing the SpongeBob SquarePants theme tune Ooh. On the top of his voice in Zulu.
Wow.
And that's like when you have that moment where I kind of get all like goosebumpy all over because I just think, this is the work that we do and look how it impacts the audience that we're delivering it to.
Amazing. So in a parallel context, could you as well delve into some of the major challenges you've encountered while striving to bridge language gaps in such a diverse region as Africa?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's essentially the work that we do. And I think, look, we know a lot more than what we knew in the beginning. But do we know enough? Oh my gosh, no, not by a long shot. So the first language we ever worked in was Swahili. And through a series of connections, managed to make contact with Swahili-speaking people who lived in Johannesburg and brought them in, and we moved ahead with the project. And we were happily dubbing and we were training everybody up and, you know, it was great. And I had people from Tanzania and people from Kenya. And, you know, Swahili was Swahili. I mean, I'm actually embarrassed to tell the story now. And 3-4 months in, the client suddenly contacted me and said, "You're dubbing in the wrong dialect." I was like, "What do you mean we're dubbing in the wrong dialect?" And so it was the best or the worst at the time because we lost the contract. The worst and the best thing that could ever have happened to me as an African and for the business. Because it started my personal journey of really getting to grips with what being an African means,
right.
What our linguistic landscape and cultural landscape looks like, and then also being able to guide and educate our clients on making the right linguistic decisions for their content in order to really connect to their audience.
Right.
That was the start of the challenge. And I mean, still now to this day, some languages are easier to work in, others aren't. But I think the bridge that we certainly strive to cross is one of cultural respect, linguistic respect, and empathy for who we are telling the story to. Because I think that if an audience knows that your intention is respectful, I think that they will forgive small, you know, nuances that maybe we didn't get right.
Mm-hmm.
And also saying, look, you know, we don't know. We're looking to you for input and tell us about your culture versus that you know, that very Western approach of we'll tell you.
Right.
The challenge it's ongoing, but I certainly think that we've made strides. And I mean, I'm so passionate about every single language and culture that is spoken across the region. And anything that I learn on a day-to-day basis just kind of adds to the value that we give audiences, which are always the most important person in our value chain. And then obviously the client to ensure that they are getting the deepest level of connection for their content.
Right. Very well said, Lewis. Talking about challenges, we know that localizing content involves a delicate balance between maintaining the originality of the concept and ensuring cultural authenticity while still keeping it appealing to the target audience. Now, how does Ear Candy navigate this challenge, especially when working on projects as varied as telenovelas, documentaries, and animated series for Africa?
Thanks, Nat. Yeah, I think the most important thing is you've just got to put the audience first. You've got to climb into their shoes. And while working with mother tongue language experts who'll be working in the dubbed language is getting an understanding of what is important for that audience and, you know, where the line sits between culturally appropriate and culturally inappropriate. You know, what are the right nuances and words and tone while still remaining true to the original storyline. So I think, you know, to give you a really great example, we dub a lot of animated series for the Amharic-speaking audience in Ethiopia. And some of the titles that we work on are Peppa Pig, as an example. And, you know, you suddenly are, I think Peppa Pig is great. My kids grew up in Peppa Pig. I think she's sweet. She's cute. But, you know, when I speak to my Zulu-speaking colleagues, as an example, and I'll come back to Amharic in a second, they'll say to me, Peppa Pig is really rude. She's very rude to her parents, and they could never, ever speak to their family members in the way that she does. And I think, you know, that's a great example of nuance and tone versus in Amharic, as an example, pigs aren't seen as cute and sweet.
Right.
You know, they're not a beloved animal. So, you know, those are things that we really have to keep in context while still giving, you know, in this case, young children in Ethiopia who are Amharic speaking, the experience of enjoying phenomenal children's content. When it comes to things like telenovelas, you know, often when speaking to audiences or connecting to audiences in Africa, there's a level of conservatism that is not necessarily intrinsic in the story that we're telling. So sometimes it's about dialing back a little bit, you know, adapting the storyline so that it still speaks to what's happening in the overall program, but maybe not necessarily being as in your face about certain themes and concepts.
Right.
So I think it really is about treating each audience individually.
Mm-hmm.
What are their needs? What are their cultural boundaries? What are their values? And then each piece of content on its own merits. And I think when you find the balance between those two, I think that's how you overcome that challenge.
Interesting. Thanks for sharing that, Lewis. Now, while we're on the issue of cultural and linguistic accuracy, let me ask you this. So I had the privilege of reading your article in the July edition of the Multilingual Magazine, where you made a point about how content localization and language dubbing in Africa is misunderstood, just like the continent itself is misunderstood. This resonated well with me because it substantiates a concern I've had even long before I became a professional in this industry. It has to do with the Western movie industry and how they portray African languages and culture in their movies. I've seen too many Western movies either set in Africa or having a plot about Africa, but obviously with producers who have little to no knowledge of Africa. For instance, in a recently popular Hollywood movie set in Africa, we see American actors who are supposed to be portraying the history and culture of the Dahomey Kingdom of Benin, rather forcing accents which seem Nigerian and Eastern African. And it made me wonder, who did they consult for linguistic and cultural authenticity? Was this person originally from Africa? And do they have an understanding of these tribes that they are trying to portray? Which brings me to my question for you, Lewis. In your view, as a localization expert and an African mother tongue advocate, how best do we not only address, but fix this issue of misrepresentation?
That is a really, really good question. And I think, look, I think it's multi-layered, and I think we can look at what resources studios need to have readily available in order to ensure that they don't make those mistakes. And I feel like we are seeing more and more that we'll be contacted by international studios certainly not this in this particular instance, but where we will be asked, questions about language and culture, and we'll be brought in as language coaches and culture coaches in order to ensure that the actors get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally think that the solution is less to do about how we assist now, and it's more about Africans, we're making great content. You know, I think going back to the Adire example, that's a phenomenal movie. You know, you look at South African series like The Brave Ones that was recently on Netflix, or the movie Inumbanumba, or The Wedding Party, you know, the Nigerian movie. I think that those stories, while they are uniquely, they're African, but obviously they're specifically South African. The examples I've used, South African and Nigerian, they have universal appeal. And so those stories need to be told around the world. And I think the more we get our content off the continent and more international audiences connect with our stories and our movies and learn more about our language and culture, I think that we'll bridge that gap, you know, that kind of level of misunderstanding and ignorance around, you know, that we don't have lions walking down our street and all live in mud huts, you know?
Exactly.
And I think that for me is the long-term solution, but it's going to take time. So yeah, it's a both and, but I feel that is the key to overcoming cultural and linguistic accuracy.
Right.
And it was a conversation I engaged in with filmmakers last week. You know, Africa is so often seen as one thing, you know? And I think that, I mean, I do it all the time. I talk about Africa, but actually we're 54 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those countries has multiple languages and cultures within its geographic borders.
Right.
And so we need to be clear about our identities. You know, I'm South African and I'm African. We need to be clear about our identities, not from a perspective of that we're producing South African content or that we're producing Nigerian content or Kenyan content, but that we are South Africans, as an example, who are producing content and we happen to come from where we come from.
Right.
So we just need to get out there and speak and mm-hmm. tell people what it is that we know. And I think that that'll engage their sense of curiosity to be more intent on getting those types of things right, so that when they make stories, they're more engaged with what is required in order to ensure that their stories are accurate.
Great. That's a very interesting perspective, which I strongly believe we as localization or language professionals should take into consideration if we really want to kick out this unfortunate trend. Now, Lois, talking about trends, being a leader in the industry, it goes without saying that you often anticipate trends and changing demands. What are some of the emerging trends in localization that you find particularly exciting, and how do you think the industry should be prepared to adapt to them?
Well, the obvious answer is going to be all around AI, synthesized voices, machine translation. And yes, of course, I mean, those are majorly disruptive factors across the language services landscape, and particularly, you know, dubbing companies. It's interesting, like I see people are either really for or really against what synthesized voices mean for them. And I think that Africa is a slightly different landscape, because I see a very clear need for both. So from a creative perspective and a job creation point of view, when telling stories, our language landscape is so diverse that it makes sense to continue working with actors and voice talent in order to achieve that, because the economies of scale just aren't there from an AI voice perspective. That being said, we have such a huge need for educational and informational content that down the line, absolutely, there's a place for machine translation and potentially synthesized voices. So I think, you know, those are the obvious trends that exist within the industry as a whole and then on the continent. For me, I think the most exciting trend that I'm seeing is that, you know, when we started Ear Candy, it was all about connecting content to Africa. So it was global content, it came from across the world, and then we would localize it for audiences in, you know, a growing number, now 30 plus languages. However, what I see as even more exciting now is that more and more we are working on content from Africa that we are then globalizing into Western languages in order for audiences across the world to watch our stories. Right. And I think that is something that I get super juiced about, because it speaks to everything that I believe and everything that I've been saying in this, you know, in this conversation.
Right.
So yeah, I think that is certainly a trend we need to watch. And I think it's a trend that content creators need to be aware of, mm-hmm. because if they're wanting to really make that work for them and make their content truly global, they've got to keep that in mind when creating their content. And I think that what I do notice about Pan-African content creators or storytellers or filmmakers is that not enough focus is put on their assets in creating assets that will enable them to extend the value chain on their story. So they are not spending enough time creating a transcript, you know, a dub-ready dialogue sheet. When they are in mix, they are not, you know, creating audio separates. And that impacts their ability to globalize their story. So I think that from a demand perspective, in order for you to take your story global, you are going to need to have to pay attention to those things. And they're not difficult to put in place. I think that so often storytellers, filmmakers, content creators, whatever you want to call them, it's all about, I've got to create the story. But the business of telling your story is ensuring that you've got that set of assets that are going to enable you to tell and retell that story in many languages. And that's where the money really sits. So I think that is something that we've got to be more aware of, and we have to get better at. We need to educate ourselves on what's required in order to make that happen accurately, and that our assets meet you know, international broadcast standards. So those are things that I harp on about all the time, and try and speak as often as possible to filmmakers about, so that they get it, and that then they not just get it, that they do it.
Wow, those are some serious nuggets of wisdom you've just shared with us, Lois. And I must say that if there's anything I have picked from our conversation today, even more than your story, which is one of dedication and achievement, it's the insightfulness of your perspective on issues. In just a short time, you've got me thinking about a whole lot, and I really appreciate that. On this note, we're bringing the curtains down on today's episode. But before we leave, Lois, what advice would you offer to aspiring entrepreneurs and professionals looking to make a significant impact in the language service industry, particularly in the area of localization?
So thank you for the compliment. I really do appreciate it. And I think that what's really important to always remember, so I mean, I don't consider myself to be particularly smart. I didn't do well at school. I mean, I think I was a C average student at best. I didn't go to university. I don't have a degree. But I know how to work hard. And I'm always clear that everything that I do is going to require learning something in order to get to where I need to go. Like, I've got a clearly defined plan in my head. Mm. I kind of draw pictures, and I draw them in my journal, and then I bring them to the office, and I show them to my management team, and sometimes they roll their eyes, and other times we kind of get it. And, you know, at the moment, I'm very clear about areas that I'm going to grow ear candy in within the area of localization. So you've got to have a plan, but keep it so simple. Like, if it can be a picture, that's always very helpful because you can keep that in your head at all times. Yes, of course, funders and banks are going to want laborious business plans, and there's a place for all of those. But know what your plan is in your head and write it down. Because when you write it down, it becomes real and you can keep on referring back to it. The other thing I would say, and it is, it's called the 10X rule. And it comes from an amazing book written by an author called Grant Cardone. And you can follow him on Instagram and LinkedIn. And I would really encourage anybody to read his book, whether you want to be an entrepreneur or not. And essentially what the core of the 10X rule is that absolutely everything takes 10 times more in order to achieve. So, you know, if it's a skill, it's going to take 10 times longer than you ever anticipated to perfect that skill. You know, there's the 10,000 hours idea. You know, it's going to take 10 times longer. It's going to take 10 times more hard work. It's going to take 10 times more failure than you ever anticipated. It's going to take 10 times more money. And I want to couch that, and I'm going to come back to the money factor now. You know, you're also going to have people who you thought were going to support you be 10 times less likely to support you. And then you're going to find crazy people that you didn't know you were ever going to find, or you never thought that they would support you. And they're going to be 10 times more likely to support you.
Right.
So it is. It's hard work. It's really, really hard work. So if you're not going to give it your all, don't start at all. But even when you think that you what you've got to give it as your all, it's going to be 10 times more than that. Going back to the money factor, don't worry about the money. I think that, yes, of course, money is critical. And don't get me wrong, I love money. And I say that every day to everybody in the office, and they all know what I mean by that, because the more money the business makes, the more people we can employ, and the more families we can feed, and the more content we can connect to, you know, within Africa. But don't let money drive your decision to start a business. Like, you've got to, I don't want to say you've got to be passionate about what it is that you want to start the business in. When I started Ear Candy, I wasn't passionate about dubbing. I didn't even know really what dubbing was. Now I know that I'm passionate about the audiences. And so what that then means is that we become by default passionate about dubbing because we want to give them the best quality product that we possibly can. But don't let money drive your decisions. You know, if you're a patient entrepreneur and you've put away your nest egg because you know you need to survive over a period of time, like, you go, right, great, I've got 6 months salary in the bank. Know that it's never going to be 6 months. It's going to be 2 years, 3 years, five, 6 years in. I was in the place where I was selling cars to pay salaries. But you do it because you are dedicated to your vision. And your vision is that story that you tell, and that picture that you draw, and that plan that you make in your head.
Right. It has been a great pleasure having you on Africa's LSP podcast, Dolores. Like I earlier said, your presence here is greatly appreciated. And we'll ensure our listeners have access to your LinkedIn profile and website so they can follow up. Once again, thank you for your time and valuable contributions, Lois.
Nat, it has been an absolute pleasure. I've really loved our conversation. And yeah, if anybody wants to reach out to me on LinkedIn and wants to ask me questions about getting involved in the localization industry, whether you are interested in becoming a translator within the dubbing sphere, please reach out. I'd love to hear from you. But thank you for the great chat. I've had an awesome time.
Thanks for tuning in to Africa's LSP podcast. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and learned something new. For feedback or inquiries, reach out to us at podcast@bolingoconsult.com. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite platforms. Until next time, stay curious and keep growing.